Halloween just may qualify as our weirdest holiday, and the costumes and the candy are just the beginning. This hour, we will parse the language of Halloween. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. English language expert Patricia O'Connor is on the show today. She's the author of Woe Is I and other books about the English language and blogs at grammarphobia.com. We'll find out where the word Halloween comes from and then explore the language of the creepy and spooky. Ghosts, haunts, witches, vampires, and so much more. You're also welcome to join the conversation with your questions about the English language. Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we're going to delve into the spooky language of Halloween. Our English language expert, Patricia O'Connor, is back today. She's the author of Woe Is I and other books about the English language. She blogs at grammarphobia.com. Hello, Pat. Hi, Pat.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Fine.
Good. Thank you so much for being here today. And let's start with that word, Halloween, which I do think is one of our weirdest holidays.
Yeah, it is. It's not a federal holiday, but we can celebrate it anyway.
Well, and thank goodness it's not, because we have to have school on Halloween, if at all
yes.
possible, right?
Oh,
because
yes.
kids
yes.
have to have a parade.
Yes, yes. Halloween, the story begins a very long time ago in the 7th century. And as you might suspect, religious elements were involved, both pagan and Christian. But to begin with the Christian church, back in the 7th century, to commemorate all the leftover saints who didn't have a day all to themselves, since we had more saints than we had days in the year, the church set aside a day devoted to all the leftovers, a date that was eventually standardized as November 1st. This became known as the Day of All Saints, or All Hallows Day. Now, hallow was an old word for a person who was holy, or a saint, and it evolved from the Old English word halig, meaning holy. Now, meanwhile, elsewhere in Europe, the Celts in the northwest of Europe and the British Isles were already celebrating October 31st, which was the final day of their calendar year, as a celebration of the Harvest Day and a Day of the Dead. Now, this was a holiday on which the Celts believed it was possible briefly to communicate with the dead. Now, as Christianity spread, these two celebrations very neatly dovetailed. The pagan festival celebrated by the Celts on October 31st, the Day of the Dead, was transformed by Christianity into the Eve of All Saints, since it was the day before All Saints Day, or it later became known as All Hallows Eve. Now, this the name of it morphed over the centuries, All Hallow Evening, All Hallow Even, and eventually it was shortened by the Scots to Halloween, that's why you still sometimes see Halloween spelled with an apostrophe between the two E's, because
okay.
it meant even.
I've often wondered about that. I thought,
yes.
what's supposed to go in there?
Right, right.
So we're all doing our best Scottish brogue, which isn't very good when we say Halloween.
Yes, yes, the good old Scots. So I mean, they always cut right to the chase linguistically. But that explains the existence of Halloween. But people often ask how to say it. Is it Halloween or is it Halloween? Hall as in holiday or Hal as in hallowed? And the answer is that etymologically it should be Hal as in hallowed, because it comes from Hallows Eve, All Hallows Eve. But the Hall pronunciation is a recent one. It's gained popularity during the last half century or so, and now dictionaries accept both pronunciations, Halloween and Halloween, so you can take your pick.
Is it a regional thing? Because I think we pretty much all say Halloween in Iowa.
Yeah, I hear mostly Halloween, but once in a while you see Halloween, and I think it's because people associate it with holiday. Okay. You know, they make that an analogy. But, you know, in the United States, we even have whimsical names for the night before Halloween. And I think you once mentioned Goosey Night. You are familiar with the term Goosey Night?
I don't think that was me. No, I don't know what
you?
Goosey Night is.
Okay, well, in some parts of the country, there are names for the night before Halloween when there's a lot of vandalism done, you know, streaming the neighbor's trees with toilet paper and things like that. And in different parts of the country, there are different names for this: Devil's Night, Cabbage Night, Goosey Night, Clothesline Night, Mischief Night, Hell Night, and so on. It varies all across the country.
Interesting. Well, and of course, there are also places where they've tried to take back that night. So in Detroit, yeah, now they brand it Angel's Night.
Oh, do they? Well, you know, it's interesting because the term Devil's Night originated in Detroit.
Right.
Yeah, okay. Well, I hadn't heard about that.
That's fighting back against all of the arson, which was a real problem.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's see if it works. Yeah,
right.
Bonfires are a big thing on Halloween. Etymologically, the word bonfire means fire of bones, because a bonfire resembles, you know, a stack of bones.
Right.
But anyway, that's a spooky etymology. But on to some other spooky words. Probably the principal word you think about, what would you say? Ghost?
Probably, sure.
Probably ghost. Now, it's from an Old English word, ghast, which means spirit or soul. So it's supposed to be the manifestation on earth of someone who's dead. And it has very old roots going back to ancient Germanic, probably prehistoric. And you can hear it today in the modern German word Geist, which means mind or spirit or ghost. And the word poltergeist comes straight from German. And poltern means to rumble or to make noise, and Geist means ghost. So poltergeist is a ghost that actually causes physical manifestations, makes noises and such.
Right, and can move stuff around,
right,
theoretically.
Move stuff around, yeah. Now, people sometimes ask why ghost is spelled with G-H. And the answer is it didn't always have an H. The G-H spelling emerged in the 1400s, and it was probably influenced by the Dutch word for ghost, which begins with a G-H. But originally in Old English, it started just with a G.
Hmm.
Now, another similar spooky word that starts with G-H is ghastly, but that's unrelated. Over the centuries, especially in Middle English, people got ghastly and ghostly mixed up, and ghast and ghost. There was an old verb, ghast, meaning to frighten. Well, originally, ghastly didn't have an H either. People began spelling it with G-H because they thought it was related to ghost, which by that time had a G-H. So that's how those things happen.
Oh, interesting. I've always thought that it looks good in there because it
does look good.
Makes me think of creepy noises like woo.
Yeah, I know. Now, when we think of ghosts, of course, we think of what they do, which is haunt. Now, this is one of those rare Halloween words that doesn't come from a Germanic. It comes from French. Actually, we got it from a French word meaning to frequent. And in English in the 1200s, this verb haunt meant to do something habitually or frequently. And then it was only a few hundred years later that a figurative use emerged in reference to supernatural beings who would haunt, that is, frequently visit those of us on Earth or hang out here. Interestingly, when people use the word haunt, like, yeah, I haunt the backyard a lot in the nice weather.
Right.
Being in my
or a
garden.
Student haunts the hallways instead
right,
of going
right.
to class.
You think of that as a figurative usage, but actually it's not. It was once a literal usage, and the ghostly one was the figurative usage.
Interesting. So that's really a word that has entirely morphed.
Yes, it has. It's gone full circle.
That's
fascinating. There are a couple of other ghostly ones that we'll get to later that also have gone full circle and come back to their original meaning. But goblin is a very interesting one. It has a very spooky history. This goes back really far to the 4th and 5th century in France, which was still then part pagan. It was in the process of being Christianized. And in those days, it was said that an extremely ugly, very nasty demon was haunting the French town of Evreux in Normandy. Now, supposedly, this creature was driven away by an early Christian bishop, who, by the way, was the godson of Pope Clement I. Anyway, he drove out this demon, and he eventually became sainted, which is one another reason why the Christians have so many saints. They sainted a lot of people back in those days. But much later, when the story of this demon and its being driven out was recorded in medieval times, the demon was referred to as, it was given the name Gobelinus, which was from, it was a medieval Latin word at the time, New Latin. And then the word Gobelin passed into Old French to mean an evil demon. And then in the early 1300s, the anglicized version, goblin, came into English. But anyway, that's it supposedly has its roots in an actual event, but by actual event, you have to take that with a grain of salt.
Right.
Now, I mentioned that most of the words that we think of as Halloween words came from the Germanic languages, but not all of them. And one that it's very interesting, ghoul, doesn't come from Germanic or the classical languages. It came into English in the late 18th century from Arabic, in which the word ghoul means an evil spirit that robs graves and feeds on corpses. Ghouls were the original zombies. And the Arabic word comes from a root that means to seize, to grab hold. So that's kind of a hair-raising word.
Yeah, interesting. And another one that has morphed quite a bit.
Yes, it has. And I mentioned zombie. Now, this is another word that we owe ultimately to Africa. In the 19th century, zombie was the name of a snake god in a West African voodoo cult. And this word was transferred to the Caribbean and to voodoo cults there. And it's related to a word in the Congo language, Nzambi, which meant God, and also related to another word, Zumbi, meaning fetish. Now, later the word zombie came to be applied to a reanimated corpse. And this is in the voodoo cult. They used it to mean a reanimated corpse. So that's more recent than ghoul, but it means kind of the same thing.
We are going to take a short break. We'll be back to talk about more Halloween language in a few minutes. We also would love to take your calls. If you have questions about the language of Halloween, that's great. But also any comments or questions about the English language, any pet peeves you want to share and talk to Pat about, give us a call, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. My guest today is Patricia O'Connor. She blogs at grammarphobia.com. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are parsing the language of Halloween with our English language expert, Patricia O'Connor. She's the author of Woe Is I and other books about the English language, and she blogs at grammarphobia.com. We're going to talk a little bit more about the language of Halloween, but you're also welcome to join our conversation. Pat can answer your questions about how we use the English language. If you have some pet peeves you need to get off your chest today, you are welcome to share them. Give us a call at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. So I think we were still in the supernatural.
Yes.
We were talking
about we were talking about zombies.
Oh, zombies. That's right. That's where we were. And that's so interesting that ghouls and zombies have that connection because, again,
right,
our language has morphed.
From the African continent. Yes.
Interesting.
And another one that also comes from the African continent is mummy, as you might expect. Remember those old Boris Karloff movies?
Yes.
They always were set in Egypt with the pyramids in the background. But, yeah, mummy It began as an Egyptian word, and it comes ultimately from the Arabic word mumiya, which meant an embalmed body. And it's derived from an Arabic word mum, for embalming wax. Now, interestingly, when the word mummy came into English by way of medieval Latin, it first meant an embalming ointment, as in mum, the wax. But in the 17th century, it became used to mean an embalmed body. So thus it acquired its original sense, mummy.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. And when do you think we started using it to mean a, now again, sort of a combination of a zombie and a mummy, the undead mummy, which is so classic at Halloween?
I don't know. It was originally in the 17th century. It just meant an embalmed body, something that was wrapped up, you know, the embalmed and wrapped up.
Right. So and we just reanimated them
right.
on our own.
And as far as reanimating, I'm guessing, but I think that's probably a Hollywood introduction. I don't know that for sure, but that's my guess.
Yeah, that seems like a pretty good guess.
Right, because they, you know, back in the 30s, there was this wonderful flowering of these movies about mummies, werewolves, vampires. I loved them. I still love them. Werewolf is a very interesting word. Etymologically, it means man-wolf, and it comes straight down through the centuries from Old English. And in fact, it's pretty much identical to the versions that were in the Old Germanic languages, Middle Dutch, Old High German, werewolf of one pronunciation or another. But it meant man-wolf. There or where meant man, and by the way, the word virile is related to that, and wolf is a very ancient word. It's been the same since, well, prehistoric. It goes back to ancient Indo-European. So a werewolf meant man-wolf.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Let's get to the phones, and then we'll get back to some more of this great Halloween language. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Linda is on the line from Cedar Rapids. Hi, Linda.
Hi. This isn't a Halloween question, but your guest used the term take it with a grain of salt, and I've always wondered where that came from.
Oh, you, Linda, you would ask me something that I don't know off the top of my head. I don't know. I don't know where that
Okay.
Yeah.
I've heard it
I've probably
so many
even
times
searched it at one time and can't remember.
Okay.
But, you know, the meaning is don't take something too literally.
Right. Well, so
throw a little grain of disbelief in there.
Well, I want to do another show about sayings and colloquialisms,
yes.
So we will
yes.
include that one when we do that show.
Start with that one.
All right. Linda, thank you so much for your call. And Cindy's also on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Cindy.
Hi.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, my comment isn't about Halloween either, unless you're talking about which candy is the best or which houses to go to. But I always cringe when I hear people say, "These ones," like they're referring to something and they say "these ones" and just saying "this one" or "these." Mm-hmm. So I wondered what's more appropriate. Am I wrong all these years?
Yes. To make a long story short, yes, you're wrong. But let me explain. When you say "this one," you're using "one" as a pronoun to stand for a single thing. When you say "these ones," you're simply using the plural form. And a lot of people have the conception that that's bad English, but it's really been around for a long time, and there's nothing, I don't think there's any foundation for the belief that it's grammatically wrong. It may be because you hear it a lot from children, and you think they should just say "these." But I've actually done an item on my blog at grammarphobia.com about the history of "these ones," and I do quote a couple I quote one linguist at least on the subtle difference between "these" and "these ones." that when you say these ones, there's sort of a, it's almost a pointing, a rhetorical sort of pointing to something. Like say you have a bunch of jelly beans in a bowl, and you, when you, you might point to them and say, I like these. But if you say these, you might mean all of the jelly beans. But if you said these ones, there's an implication that you're talking about a particular color of jelly bean or flavor. So there's a particularizing in there. But it's not grammatically incorrect.
Okay, that makes sense now that you referred to jelly beans. Makes me hungry too.
Right, and so Cindy, does it make you feel better or is it still going to drive you nuts?
No, it actually makes me feel better, and I'll try not to. I don't correct people when they say that because I never knew for sure, but it always sounded not right to me. Now that I know it's correct in the way it's used, I will be okay with it.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks a lot for your call.
She's a very broad-minded, interesting person because a lot of people would say, I don't care. I still think it's wrong.
Yeah, it's hard to let these things go.
And
I'm always learning from you, Pat, that things that I think are absolutely incorrect are at least have a small kernel of correctness to them. It's hard to let it go, though. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We are talking about words today. We have English language expert Patricia O'Connor on the show. We've been parsing the language of Halloween today. We will continue to do that, but also we'll take your calls. 866-780-9100. And let's talk about witches and wizards, because obviously this is something that we love on Halloween.
Yes. I mean, isn't that every little girl's favorite costume?
This year it's Elsa from Frozen. But
oh, is it?
But the witches are certainly an old standby.
See, if a kid came to my door in that costume, I wouldn't know what.
You'll have to look it up.
Yeah,
be
I
prepared,
guess I would.
Because you will have some Elsas at your door and some Annas too.
Okay, well, witch is has a very old history, as you might guess. Now, Old English had a verb, witchen, spelled W-I-C-C-I-A-N, witchen.
Which apparently we all say incorrectly because we would say wiccan.
I'll get into that.
Okay.
Yes, it's witchen in Old English, and it's meant to practice sorcery. And there were both masculine and feminine nouns for the sorcerers themselves. A man was called a witcha, spelled W-I-C-C-A, pronounced witcha in Old English. And a woman was a witchy, W-I-C-C-E. Now, over time, you know, Old English lost its inflections, and these two words, witcha and witchy, eventually dropped their endings. They merged, and they become one unisex word, witch, in the 1200s. There were male and female witches. Now, it apparently, people seem to feel that we ought to have a masculine word again. Before I get to wizard, the word for the modern pagan religion of witchcraft, which, by the way, is not very old, it dates from the 1950s, it took its name from the Old English masculine word witcha and the spelling W-I-C-C-A, but followers of the religion pronounce it Wicca. But originally it was Witcha. But
and
if
that's
you look
only,
up the name
only
of the
dates
religion,
back to the
Witcha.
1950s. That's fascinating.
Yes, yes. But back to witch. When it took on its present form in the 1200s, it was used for both men and women. But over the time, we started thinking of witch as principally a feminine word. And the word wizard emerged in the 15th century, that's the 1600s, a male counterpart. Wizard literally means, etymologically it means wise man. Wiz for wisdom, wise, and the suffix ard is sort of a noun-forming suffix that usually stands for a man, but you can see a counterpart of it in coward, drunkard, bastard. It's the ard ending was a noun forming ending. So wizard literally meant wise man. Later in the 16th century, it was really settled out as the male counterpart of witch and meant a man who practices magic or sorcery.
And would people have originally said wizard, or would it have always been wizard?
I think it probably was always, it might have been wizard in the beginning. I don't know. I that's hard to say. I haven't actually researched that. I could find that out, but I can't find it right now. But eventually the sibilant in the middle became a hard Z sibilant, sort of on a parallel to wisdom and wise, which have a hard sibilant sound. So wizard is, parallel to those.
There's, when we talk about witches and wizards, there's another word that gets used in conjunction with talking about these people, but obviously it's something we use all the time, and that is weird. I mean, I think about
weird,
Macbeth
right.
and the weird sisters.
Correct, the weird sisters.
Is that related somehow to witches and
well,
wizards?
Well, it is, but I'm glad you ask about this, because when Shakespeare used the phrase weird sisters in Macbeth to refer to the witches, he used weird in a different way than we do now, and he used it in a way that's now obsolete. In Old English, the noun weird, spelled with a W, meant predestined fate. It was a noun for your destiny, your fate. And from around 1400, the term weird sister, and it was used many times before Shakespeare, a weird sister was someone who had supernatural powers and could control your destiny, change your fate. It wasn't until the 19th century that the word weird came to mean what we think of as weird, strange, uncanny, or even eerie. So we think of weird sisters as like spooky sisters, but that wasn't really, the word weird had a different meaning back in Shakespeare's time.
Very interesting, and clearly one we use a lot today.
But I mentioned eerie just now, which is one meaning of the modern weird. Now, there's a spooky one, and this we also owe to the Scots. They got it through Germanic, but eerie was also very old, like weird. It was recorded in writing in the early 1300s, and it originally meant fearful or timid. So an eerie person was a frightened person. It wasn't until the late 18th century that it came to mean inspiring fear, as in gloomy or strange or weird, you know, spooky.
Yeah.
So that changed over time.
Well, we do have a Halloween question. This is from Nick in Chicago. Where does the name jack-o'-lantern come from?
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. I think I've mentioned on the show before that Jack has been used over the years in English just as a kind of generic term for a man, sort of like Tom, Dick, and Harry. A jack-o'-lantern originally meant a man with a lantern or a night watchman, and this was in the 17th century. So if you use the term jack-o'-lantern, you'd probably mean the night watchman coming down the street with his lantern. This later became associated with Halloween and large carved vegetables in the 19th century. Now, early on, the British were hollowing out large turnips. They used turnips. Right.
Well, it's big funny because now white pumpkins are all the rage. Yeah. What's the difference between a white pumpkin and a big carved turnip?
Right. Well, the British hollowed out turnips, carved scary eyes and mouths.
You know, we haven't done our pumpkins yet. Maybe we'll just do turnips this year.
Yeah, if you find a big enough one. I mean, I can't imagine how you'd get a big enough one to put a candle inside, but that's what they did. Meanwhile, the Americans made their jack-o'-lanterns out of pumpkins. But people started talking about carved pumpkins with candles inside as jack-o'-lanterns. They sort of transposed the meaning from the night watchman carrying a lantern to a lantern that was a man's face. So that's where that name comes from.
Oh, very interesting.
Yeah. But pumpkin, that's another interesting word. By the way, it didn't always have a K. The original English was pumpian, and later pumpin, and the K was added later, but it can actually be traced to the Greek word pepon, which meant a large melon or edible gourd, from an earlier word that meant cooked by the sun or ripe. So that's pumpkin. But I think pumpkins make make a better jack-o'-lantern than a turnip.
Well, I think you're not alone, Pat. I mean, clearly.
Yeah, I actually, believe it or not, last year I went to an adult pumpkin carving party, and one woman brought little wires, and she actually carved her pumpkin with teeth and put little wires on them. So her pumpkin had braces.
Nice. That would
be that brilliant or
what? That's brilliant. And it would be really, really hard to do with a turnip.
She won the prize.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment to talk more about Halloween language and the English language with Patricia O'Connor. She blogs online at grammarphobia.com. You can follow her on Twitter at grammarphobia as well. Please join the conversation, 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We are talking about the English language today, and we are parsing the language of Halloween with our English language expert, Patricia O'Connor. She's the author of Woe Is I and a number of other books about the English language. And we have a lot of people who want to get involved in this conversation, Pat. So let's go first to Sue in Iowa City, who has some information about when we animated those mummies. Hi, Sue.
Hello.
Hi.
What would you like to talk about?
Well, you were talking about mummies, and there was the question of when the concept of the scary, shuffling, animated, spooky mummy. Mm-hmm. And Hollywood was mentioned, but I wanted to let you know that it actually predates that.
Oh.
The very first use of an animated mummy as a sinister kind of predatory figure was in 1892, when Arthur Conan Doyle of Sherlock Holmes fame wrote and published a short story called Lot Number 249, which was the lot number of an auction sale for an Egyptian mummy that was bought by an Oxford College student who then uses Egyptian magic to reanimate the mummy and send it after his enemy.
What a great story. Now, I wonder, was that the story that was dramatized in the movie, The Mummy?
Absolutely. It was the first reference to a mummy, mummified character that could be used as a horror story plot, and this was the story that they used for that very first reanimated mummy film with the Tana Leaves and Princess Ananka and
Tana
the whole
Leaves.
Thing.
Oh, Sue, thank you so much for sharing.
You know, you're very welcome.
The 1890s were just so ripe with spooky stuff.
Well, there was no electricity, right?
So
lots of spooky stuff must have gone on. It's always dark with the flickering candlelight and the lanterns.
Oh gosh, yes.
All right, let's go next to Lynn on the line in Ames. Hi, Lynn. Lynn, are you there? Oh, we seem to...
Uh-oh.
That's all right.
I think she was seized by the zombie.
It's possible. It's possible. Let's try Glenn in Jefferson. Hi, Glenn.
Not Glenn, too.
Oh, dear.
Oh, my gosh.
This is starting to be
it's
a little
epidemic.
Spooky, I can tell you that much. All right,
Does anyone ask about vampire?
Let's try Tara first, and then if that doesn't work, then we'll talk about vampires. All right, Tara? All right.
Oh, dear.
I suspect
they're
we're having
like
some,
flies.
I suspect we're having some phone problems is what I suspect. Let's talk about vampires.
Yes, well, this is another word that doesn't come from Germanic or Latin or even Asia, unless you consider Russia part of Asia, Well, anyway, it might be. Anyway, vampire comes from a Tartar Kazan language that was spoken way back when in an area that's now just east of Moscow in Russia. And in this language, a word meaning witch, that was pronounced like vampire, was borrowed into Russian, then into Hungarian, where it took its pretty much final form. Then on, it went on into French, German, and English. So I guess there's a reason why a lot of those vampire legends are set in Transylvania and areas in the Hungarian neighborhood. But it came into English in 1734, meaning a corpse that comes to life at night and sucks the blood of the living for its nourishment.
Fascinating. I would have thought that it would have actually originated in Hungary.
Well, it didn't. It
okay.
moved into Hungary, and it was
and
kind of finalized
the
pronunciation.
Right.
They ran with it. Yeah. Well, they had the the landscape and the castle, crumbling castles, and all that stuff. So it was a natural. Had to happen.
That's so interesting. I wonder when the bat connection.
Well, that was later in the 18th century. A French biologist used the term vampire to name a type of blood-sucking bat. And actually, vampire bats are, they're kind of cute little devils, and they aren't really as scary as you might think, although they're always photographed with their mouths open and their fangs showing, but probably they aren't really about to attack the photographer. They're just saying, huh? What's that? And their teeth show.
Right.
But they're more or less harmless, except for the diseases that they might spread. They prey mostly on livestock.
Right.
Not on people.
Right. Apparently they do not prefer humans.
No.
Nor do they turn them into bats.
No.
All right. Let's try these phones again. Luann is on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Luann.
Hi.
So good to hear your voice.
Yeah. I was listening to your thing. When I was growing up back in the 50s and early 60s, we had a night. We lived on the edge of Marion, and we were kind of our own little neighborhood. And we had a night that was called corning. And we would go and get field corn from the fields, you know, and shell it. And then we'd go and throw it at everybody's houses.
Oh, my.
It's better than raw eggs.
Yeah, instead of eggs and that, but we called it corning, and we would just, you know, and that's always what we did the night before Halloween, and then on Halloween we'd go trick-or-treating and that.
Well, it lasted until
they started building new homes across the street, and we would throw the corn at the fiberglass garage doors, and it made a great noise, but the people didn't like it real well.
And was this widespread?
No, it just seemed to be in our neighborhood.
Okay, so that was just your tradition and your name for it.
Right, yeah.
And I think I understand the origin of the name.
Yeah, corning.
Yeah.
Oh, Luann, thank you so much for calling.
You're welcome.
All right, you can join us at 866-780-9100. Aaron is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Aaron.
Hi. Forgive me if you've covered this already. I just started tuning in, but where I come from, it's a very small town in south central Iowa, we call trick-or-treat night beggar's night.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering the origin of that.
Yeah, and that's a common
Well,
beggar's term.
Night, yeah. It just means that you're begging. You go from door to door begging for candy. So that's why it's called beggar's night. And the trick-or-treat, I think that's not practiced as widely now as when I was a kid, but this is the usual chant by children who... They go out in costume and they threaten to play a trick unless they're given a treat. Or if it looked at another way, I'll give you a little jingle or something if you give me a treat.
Right, and there are places where, if, for example, in Des Moines, there is still the tradition where you have to tell a joke to get your candy. Although
it's always a really lame joke.
Yeah, terrible jokes. We're actually going to
the biggest pencil in the world, Pennsylvania.
Right, we're going to talk about the origins of that tradition on Friday on News Buzz on our other show, River to River, which is on at noon. So we'll find out more about that. But Beggar's Night is interesting, just because when I was growing up, we always trick or treated on Halloween. We never called it Beggar's Night because we didn't need to, but there are places where they have the trick-or-treating on other nights, and yeah. I think that probably necessitated the term.
Well, I think that sometime in some municipalities, you know, October 31st isn't always on the same day of the week all the time. And a lot of towns will set a night that's official when kids are, you know, allowed to go around. And they'll announce that, you know, trick-or-treating will take place between the hours of X, Y, Z on Wednesday the 29th, say, instead of the actual 31st. You know, I don't know if they do that in Iowa City, but in a lot of towns they'll do that just as a way of keeping control over
right.
what goes on.
A small
effort.
And
so you don't have kids coming to your door at 10:30
right.
or something. But then there are a lot of towns now where they've banned trick-or-treating for safety reasons and just encourage kids to have Halloween parties in people's homes, or they might have a Halloween party at the local school gym or something like that.
Well, I could do without the giant bags of candy, but I would hate to lose the experience. Lynn is on the line next in Ames. Hi, Lynn.
Hi.
Hi, I can hear you this time. What's your question?
It drives me crazy when people say, I could care less.
Mm-hmm.
And what they actually mean is, I couldn't care less. And I was wondering how it got changed to, I could care less.
Actually, it's about mid-20th century. And I have a little essay on my blog at grammarphobia.com about I could care less and how it evolved among young people and really what the purpose of it is. And I think that it's a deliberate irony.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I would like to think that, Pat. But...
Yeah. Well, the rhythms and inflections of I could care less are very different than I couldn't care less. And I think there's a reason for it. It's almost as if you're saying, well, I suppose I could care less, but I'd have to really come up
I'd have to really
a weird
try.
Situation.
Right.
I'd have to really try to find something that I cared less about.
Huh.
I don't know, Lynn, if you're wired or anything, but you might check out what I've written about that. It doesn't bother me as much as it bothers a lot of people. I think it's youthful irony. I don't think people are making a grammatical mistake. They know the difference between could and could not.
Well, that's generous of you, Pat. I like that. And that makes me feel better about it. I understand that now literally can mean figuratively, and I have a really hard time accepting
that. Well,
I have a hard time
with it, too.
All right.
But, you know, the language has changed a lot. If it didn't, we'd still be using weird to mean, as a noun, to mean fate.
That's true.
See? So
that's true. There's a constant evolution.
You have to go with the flow.
All right. So... There's this orange and black color scheme that we have on Halloween.
Right.
What do you know about that?
Well, the orange is probably from the pumpkins, the jack-o'-lanterns, and the black is a reference to, it's a symbol of death and a reminder that Halloween was once a festival of the dead. Now, it's not a pretty color scheme, but then, you know, Halloween is sort of a wacky holiday, so I think that the color scheme is equally wacky.
Well, indeed.
When do you wear orange and black? I mean, please.
Right. Well, it depends on what school your kids go to.
Yeah.
the funny thing about that, then, did it used to be white and black, or kind of an off white for the turnips, Pat?
I don't think we had color schemes back before. Before pumpkins.
Right. It would have meant dyeing your clothes.
Right.
Or...
right.
That's very funny. Let's see. Anna is on the line in Indianola. Oh, let me see if I can get to Anna. Hello, Anna.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. I was just listening to you speak about Beggar's Night a couple minutes ago. My husband and I moved to Iowa a little over a year ago, and we've lived in 8 states now and had never heard of Beggar's Night, and so we completely missed Halloween last year and trick-or-treating because we didn't know.
Oh, no.
So is it just an Iowa thing?
Pat, do you know?
Are you talking about the actual tradition of going door-to-door?
No, she's talking about the idea of having it.
Calling
it
Beggar's
Night. I've never heard of it called Beggar's Night, anything but trick-or-treating until we moved here.
Well, it's called different things in different regions of the country. I had always heard both trick-or-treat and Beggar's Night when I was growing up in Iowa. And pretty much every other place I've lived, I've heard both. Where did you live before that you never heard Beggar's Night?
Pretty much from here to the New England area, so New York City, Boston, Minnesota, Nebraska, Ohio, Michigan.
I'm surprised you never heard Beggar's Night. Huh.
Interesting. So you missed some sort of announcement from the town of Indianola that said Beggar's Night was not on Halloween.
Right. And then so we were trying to do some research about this and ask people, and we just couldn't figure out if this was just an Iowa thing. And on the Wikipedia page online, it did say something about Western Massachusetts also has something called Beggar's Night that they do the night before Halloween. But I just wondered... I just haven't been able to get any information on specifically the term Beggar's Night and how it came to happen the night before Halloween in this state or this area.
Well, and it's not everywhere in Iowa, Anna. Beggar's Night is the night before Halloween in much of central Iowa, but every municipality gets to make their own decision about when Beggar's Night is. And a lot of towns just do it on Halloween.
I see. Mm-hmm.
When I was growing up, it was always October 31st.
Right.
So,
are you clear on it this year? Have you gotten in touch with me?
We've got it figured out this year. So if they have Beggar's Night the night before Halloween, does trick-or-treating not happen on the 31st?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
You'd be wise to save a few Snickers bars just in case.
Yeah. Just in case. Well, thank you so much.
You're
All right,
welcome.
Anna, good luck. I hope this is a more enjoyable Halloween for you and your family. Welcome to Iowa.
Thank you.
We have this note. This is from Terry in Iowa City, who says, I grew up in Fort Madison, and we went corning, too. We threw the corn at windows, which really startled the people inside the house.
What do you know?
Well, Pat, I hope we're not bringing this back.
Oh, my.
This is
I'm going to have
fault.
To add
we
that
don't
to my
endorse
list of, like,
it.
Goosey Night. Did they call it corning night, I wonder?
I guess so.
Oh, my.
I'm not endorsing it. I want to be on record. I don't know how you feel
but
about
I'd
it,
But I'd rather
Pat.
Have grains of corn than eggs.
Yeah.
I mean, after all, crows would clean up the corn, I would think.
I'm not endorsing throwing anything at anybody's houses. All right, Pat, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Patricia O'Connor is the author of Woe Is I and a number of other books about the English language. She blogs at grammarphobia.com. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.
To mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
He did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
He did the mash.
He did the monster mash. From my laboratory in the castle east to the master bedroom where the vampires feast. The ghouls all came from their humble abode to get a jolt from my electrode.
They did the mash.
They did the monster.